Houston, contact with a test one.
Touch out the club.
And we're live. This is the Space Cowboys podcast. Do you remember which episode, Thijs?
No, I said I was going to lose count, and now I lost count.
It must be episode 14 or 15 or something.
Yeah, I think 14 sounds good.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah. Hopefully it's in the title somewhere as well. Yeah. But this is a special episode. Like the past three episodes, we've had some really great conversations. This time, it's kind of like a technical, how do you say it? An achievement that
this podcast exists.
A feat, yeah, that it exists at all. Because you are in the BNR studios right now in Amsterdam, right?
I'm in BNR's podcasting studio. That's right.
Yes, I am. In the Morvan in France, I'm overlooking a whole bunch of farms and fields and some cows.
Good for you.
Very good. And our guest, Michel van Baal.
He's in Delft, indeed.
In Delft, yes.
That's in Delft, because he is not only a space engineer, but he's also the PR guy and spokesman of the Technical University in Delft.
That's correct.
Yes. Welcome, Michel, to our podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah,
and we're going to talk to you about the role which can't be underestimated of PR in space.
Yeah,
in space flight.
Yeah. PR in space. Yeah, and it's an interesting topic because it's super hard. So I've noticed.
It's not
across,
that hard to sell space. Come on.
No, but there's so many challenges.
Everybody loves space flight. Yeah, there's challenges, of course.
Yeah, everybody loves space flight, yet it is not part of, I would say, public discourse all the time. Maybe over the past few years it has increased, but it's hard to get it on the front page.
And people can be critical of it because it's expensive.
Yeah. Is that something you feel as well, Michel? Does that happen a lot?
No, actually, I completely disagreeing with you. So
great, we got a lot to talk about that.
Otherwise, it would be.
I have to think back of one particular case. I once wrote this opinion piece for a Dutch national newspaper. Mm-hmm. Because it was around New Horizons visiting Pluto.
Yeah.
And it was just sending back these pictures of the heart and just the first close-up pictures of Pluto ever. And then this newspaper, the Volkskrant, it's called, decided for 2 days in a row not to put Pluto on the front page, but go for the Tour de France on the front page. And I was just like, what? we're rediscovering this object in our solar system. It's a really significant moment. Why is it so hard to put that on the front page?
To put it in perspective, I'm now indeed working at Delft University, but I was working for ESA for 10 years and did communications there. And the first thing I did in my sort of professional life on that end was that one of the main things I did was the PR campaign for the first flight of André Kuipers. And
Dutch astronaut,
yes. And by the way, various other astronauts that are completely unknown here in the Netherlands, but nevertheless, the big one was the Dutch one, at least for me. And that was quite spectacular from a PR point of view, and also from a general interest point of view. And still, to this specific moment, if I visit schools, and occasionally I meet André there. The funny thing is that here on Dutch schools there is one thing bigger, one person bigger than André Kuipers, and that is Santa Claus.
Saint Nicholas.
Yeah, Dutch version of Santa Claus for anybody who doesn't know.
Yeah, it will be difficult to explain to non-Dutch listeners, but there is first you have Sinterklaas, and then you have a gap for a little while, then you have André Kuipers, then you have a huge
gap, it's true,
and then you have the rest of the world. And that's also the reason why communications, especially in about space, is so fascinating, because it does. It's one of the things that appeal to young children, together with dinosaurs, for instance. Dinosaurs and astronauts are the two top topics for every kid in the range, let's say, 6 to 10 years old, more or less. It appeals to the fascination of very young children, which says something about the power of communications in space.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And
hey, so
we have plenty to talk about. So we have plenty to talk about for a whole hour, I think, right? Yeah.
But let's do the stories of the week first, right?
Exactly. Let's first go to the stories of the week. Herbert, you want to kick this off?
Yeah. Well, I have one modest thing to report, and that's the fact that SpaceX has got a test location, and I'm trying to go there on my laptop right now. It's at Boca Chica in Texas. They offer via YouTube a live view of their Starship Hopper test launches.
What is the Starship Hopper?
Starship Hopper. It's a test spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... it will run a series of tests, the first of which will not even bring the spacecraft from the ground, but at some time in the future they will. So they have this view of the test site 24/7, and as long as nothing happens there, they may also turn the camera around and bring beaches into view,
which is
nice also. But I'm watching the test location right now, and nothing is happening there. But in the coming weeks and months, there will be test launches there, and some of those will be spectacular. I mean, you may remember the first test launches of the Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
The first of which didn't even get off the ground. Then it did some modest hops. And in the end, they even got to space and brought the spacecraft back and have it land on its tail.
Yeah.
Right?
This time it's about the Starship that SpaceX is building.
That's right.
To get to Mars.
That's right. It's a prototype Mars craft. So there's really something.
Yeah.
And I would recommend that everybody takes a look there once in a while and, be on the lookout for the video clips that they will no doubt release as soon as something of importance happens.
As soon as something finally hopped.
That's right.
Yeah, because I think that's what they're
good at SpaceX, you know, use video as a PR tool. We'll talk about that with Michelle later on in this podcast. That's their way of communicating with the public and present themselves as an important company with important things to do.
Yeah, I think it might be important to update some people on what the Starship is, right? It's going to be this huge rocket, very retro looking, very very much like the Tintin rocket, but then made out of steel completely, in order to get to Mars. And like all the other rockets that SpaceX is building, it needs to have some sort of reusable element. So it needs to be, this particular spacecraft, I think, needs to be able to launch and then land on Mars and then lift off again and come back and land again and land again on Earth. So it's going to be a crazy machine. And I saw that Elon Musk tweeted that there were some problems with frost forming. It's apparently cold in Texas. There was frost forming. People saw some steam coming from here and there, but
and we remember frost as a deal breaker in the space shuttle launches, right?
Yeah.
Because it was the cause of the Challenger accident.
I don't think it's the temperature.
If
I can interrupt for a moment, I don't think so much the temperature of Texas itself is the problem. Yeah, but.
Oh, okay.
These are they're using fuels that are cooled to extreme low temperatures, so at some point can get problems like frozen valves and other equipment that isn't functioning anymore due to the low temperature of the fuel. So it's not so much the low temperature of the Texas night.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, probably the temperature of the fuel, which is probably, especially because... Yeah.
No frost in Texas, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was already...
Bad.
Sounds a lot more reasonable than frost in Texas, yeah, that's
yeah.
True.
To which I may add, if I can, that I'm a bit skeptical to this project, and the reason for that is a business model. But I'm sure that we'll get to that in later.
Please elaborate right now. What's up?
Yeah, well...
What's your problem with it?
I have mixed feelings, to be honest with you, on the topic of the ambitions of SpaceX, in a sense that what they do with Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy is really impressive, to be very sure. But it's also accompanied by a business model of launching satellites and earning money by simply putting commercial and mostly, by the way, government projects into space, which they like it looks at the moment, can do cheaper than the competition can do it. But it's a completely different ballgame when you build a rocket to go to Mars, which originally, by the way, spaceship was called BFR, the big and the F I'm not going to pronounce on radio. rocket.
The big effing rocket.
The big effing rocket.
Yeah, on the SpaceX floor, apparently the big freaking rocket.
Yeah, that's okay too.
Which is a joke that refers, by the way, to the good old game of Doom, because...
Of course.
Yeah, but...
The BFG.
You have to admit that at least Elon Musk is a proper nerd in that respect. But building a rocket...
You had the BFG, the big freaking gun.
Indeed.
And it was great. Yeah, you could... slaughter a lot of zombies with that.
For those who lived in the 90s, yeah, indeed. But the problem with this specific spaceship is that there is no business model, in the sense that even if he would manage to get the thing to Mars, which is quite an achievement because half out of all the Mars mission fail, so far historically have failed. So it would already be a huge achievement. But getting the business model to work, just do the calculation. I have no idea how that's going to work. And his personal pockets are not that deep.
No, and you're not going to do any mining on Mars, at least not for the purpose of getting stuff back to Earth.
Yeah.
That would be far too expensive to do anything.
And even if you can get 200 people to pay $1 million for a trip, then you're still not in the green numbers, huh?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah,
this is an excellent reason to be skeptical. Okay, Thijs, go ahead.
$250 million, I believe, is what he needs at first just to get it off the ground.
It's
a lot. But is it not possible that he just puts all his profit in that as sort of like a pet project?
Yeah, to do it once maybe. Yeah, but again, that could be. But again, I mean, the thing that you have to admire in Elon Musk is that his ambitions are on some level over the top of ridiculous. But what he achieves is really admirable. So in that, but that makes communications also, and we have to go to the topic at some point in this. Communications really. Yep. Difficult to read because what is real and what is hard marketing, it's very difficult to say.
I have a story that's also about PR, I guess, because it's only an announcement. It's an announcement of a press conference that's coming up. If I can just pull it up. Michel, we're first going to yours. No, I got it. Yeah, sorry, I'm out in the field in France trying to get this all working, and it's working. So,
all distracted the Event Horizon by beautiful
Telescope Project and the National Science Foundation will hold a press conference to announce a groundbreaking result. This is going to happen next week, on the 10th of April, and something's going to happen. So, there's something's going to be. Apparently, this Event Horizon telescope has found has made a picture of a black hole. That's probably the idea, and it's supposedly going to be huge. And we're going to have one of the team members actually on the show in 2 or 3 weeks. I think 3 weeks from now, Herbert.
Who's the team member?
And so been trying to do is trying to take a picture of a black hole, which is really hard because the whole idea of a black hole is that you can't see it. So,
but you can see things around it
pop up everywhere now. One of my friends said that he thought it was going to be a portal to a different dimension that they discovered.
Sure.
I'm not sure. but it seems like they built this gigantic telescope. Or it's more like a collection of different telescopes all over the Earth. And that they all paired at this one black hole. And it's coming up. That's all I have. Like, I don't know what it is. Sarah also told us that it's going to be huge. And I'm just saying, there's going to be something about black holes next week. And people have to be on the lookout.
I can jump in right now to tell you that Sarah Markov will be in our podcast, the one we record on the 24th of April. So that's great. 3 weeks from now.
Yeah.
That will be Space Cowboys number 18.
Uh-huh.
And that means, I wasn't sure when we started this one, that this one is number 15.
Oh, okay. Oh, this one's number 50.
So
okay, good.
This one is number 50. So that's to set the record straight, okay?
Yeah, to set the record straight. So then we can dive into, like, not only what she found, but also how she found it. So
that's right.
Look out for that. Yeah. Michelle, then we're
do you have down. Any more? Okay, you don't have any more stories of the week?
No, like I said, like sometimes it's
good.
Up and sometimes it's down. Sometimes it's
beautiful.
There's a lot of news, and suddenly there's not that much news. Well, that's just how it goes.
No problem.
Well, there was something about.
Well,
there was quite a lot of fuss about SLS in America last week.
Okay. What happened?
Well,
so that's your story of the week.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm completely unprepared, but yes.
Okay. Okay. Come on. Bring it on.
I noticed that that there was quite a lot of discussion in the United States on the space launch system. It's, mm-hmm. Let's say the NASA the very big rocket that NASA is building for space exploration, which is a nightmare project, by the way, for various reasons. And now apparently that in America it was on the table that they might consider moving the Orion launches to the moon and to Mars that NASA is doing, to move that to other rockets, because the SLS rocket is delayed so much now, it's almost become political unacceptable, which would even put it on the table to see if you can get Orion on the SpaceX rockets, which they were now announcing to actually go and explore. I think it's impossible, by the way, but it tells you something about the slight panic that there is in the United States about their pretty hopeless exploration program.
Yeah, and it's been going on for years, right? The whole delays with SLS and the questions about SLS, especially after Falcon Heavy launch.
Yeah, it's a very difficult project. It has been mostly set up to make sure, quite often this is the main reason in the United States, that there would not be loss of jobs after they quit the space shuttle program. So they sort of went on with the project to develop something new out of the space shuttle infrastructure, which is SLS. Mm-hmm. But actually, by doing so, by in my opinion, while not having a program to actually use the rocket for, so you're developing a rocket which doesn't have a real purpose, and that's always. Well,
that sucks.
Yeah, it's no worse, but yes. And it brings memories back to the famous Russian Buran program, which had a very similar problem in the sense.
Was that the space shuttle?
That was the Russian space shuttle that flew twice.
Ah, yeah.
Which was a very bad idea because the original approach of the Russians of separating people and freight is a very good idea. And then suddenly they copied the shuttle, which is a really bad idea. So
because the shuttle was a bad idea to begin with.
It was definitely a bad idea to begin with, yeah. And at least it was too early. It's a little bit like the supersonic airplane. Concorde. Thank you very much. Also, wonderful technology, but too early in the stage of development. And now SLS feels a little bit like the same, that they're copying, they're creating a rocket while they don't have really a purpose to that rocket can be used for.
Yeah. And so that now again they are in doubt if they should actually continue the whole project.
It is delayed and delayed and delayed, and at some point, your whole exploration program, which by the way always is cancelled by the president and then put back on the agenda by the same president, cancelled by the next president, which is already happening for 20 years. Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. We'll see where that goes. I mean, it's the whole. Sort of private industry slowly taking over, and the government not knowing what its role is, right? Even though SLS is developed by Boeing.
Yeah, it's. I disagree a bit to the frame of the private government taking over, because what many people don't understand is that companies like SpaceX, they run on government money. Yeah.
That's true.
It's not that it's SpaceX or Elon Musk's money. But it's government money coming from NASA. The only difference between SpaceX and Boeing is that project management and how to develop the rocket is completely with SpaceX. So NASA tells them, I give you a lot of money if you give me a decent rocket. And it's your job to figure out how to do it. Well, in the early days, in the previous time, they were very much on top of the project management, but it's still the money. It's still government money. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Michel, shall we now give you a proper introduction? We've done so at the beginning, but so you have worked as a spokesperson for ESA, but nowadays you work at the TU Delft, the Technical University at Delft.
Yeah, Delft University of Technology in English officially, yeah.
Thank you, yeah. Yeah, they all got the official English names now, right?
We have both, but we use TU Delft also internationally.
And so how long have you then been in the business of promoting space?
Well, when I was in with ESA, I've done that for about 10 years. And then I still occasionally do things with space, because also in Delft University, it's part of the various activities that we have. And quite logically, that kind of thing always ends up with me. So communications and space is in my backyard for about 20 years, I think.
And it's a very sort of like a grateful field, you said. You said it's great for kids. I think last week, Herbert, we talked about how it also cuts across the political aisles. So whether you're conservative or liberal, there's also broad support for space.
There is, but also there's always a conservatism as far as budgets are concerned.
Yeah.
And there's there's some differences there from one political party to another.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So I can't find the right word right now, but people can be fussy with money, and not all political parties are the same in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you look at that, Michel? Do you get the same sort of support from all sides?
Yeah, no, what you can see with politicians, and this is not only so in the Netherlands, but in basically every country, is that space is very much seen as an instrument for employment or for technology development as such, and not so much as let me put it that way, as a tool which is useful for society or inspirational. If we're talking about manned space, which in my opinion is a relatively small part of space, but if you talk about manned space, the main purpose of that is inspiration. This is the André Kuiper's effect at schools, which I think is highly valuable, but it's very difficult to price. While the amount of people that have a job is something that is economically quite easy to judge. Let me put it that way. The other thing that I noticed, which is difficult for politicians, is that space in the end also gives you something useful. For instance, satellite navigation, although that's military space, but also Earth observation and the whole discussion that we're having about our climate is very much depending on satellite observations. And but the value of that is very difficult to indicate. Well, what is it worth to us that we know how our climate is developing?
Yes, but still, ESA has done its very best to do just that. ESA has more than once presented reports in which they try to calculate the contribution of ESA to, I'm not quite sure, the Dutch or the European economy. Mm-hmm. And show well how much budget goes in and how much value comes out for society, for companies, yeah, and stuff. So this intrinsic, the inspirational value of space is one thing, but the space business itself has always tried to prove the economic value of space, right?
That's true, but it's also a little bit of a trap in a sense that you might say, okay, for every euro that we spend on space industry, we get 2 euros back. I know these mm-hmm. lines, I remember them well. But it is also a vulnerable discussion, because if you go that route, then one might say, yeah, but if we put this 1 euro into a completely different area of the economy and we get back 3 euros, then that's the better choice. But
can you explain then to me why does ESA go that route? Because they've done so. Yeah. And what you're actually explaining to us is this is a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't know why ESA is doing it. Well, what I do know is that politicians are sensitive to it, which might be the reason that they do it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It feels like the wrong argument, in the sense that we need meteorological information. We want satnav. We also don't want to have our satnav depending on a strictly American military force, because currently GPS is controlled by American military. Slightly yeah. uncomfortable with that. And we want to know our climate. We want to do science. Sorry, public, it's going to cost you money. This is sort of infrastructure. Infrastructure is an investment. On the same thing, we also have to be fair and square to the public that space is an expensive thing to do. But if we do it with many people together, which we do, it's for you, it's relatively cheap. And look, this is what you're getting back for your buck. The economic route for me, I find it very, how do you say it? The Dutch word is armoedig. If you can come up with it, then
poor.
Poor. Yeah, it's poor. You're saying it's not the right argument, also, because
it seems to me now that we have three arguments. One was it's inspirational. Mm-hmm. That was actually what you said, Michel. Is the real value of a space? Then we have useful value of satnav and all that, and the third one is economic value. But whereas you started off with calling the inspirational one the most important one, you also tell us that the useful value is something that's very important.
True. I would like to even add a fourth one, which is international political stability. Because the one thing that is undervalued, in my opinion, is how space actually contributes to international stability, in the sense that even now the United States and Russia can be on very grim terms towards each other, but they still together have to keep a few people alive of both their nationalities, which from a symbolic point of view is very powerful. And also, I mean, keep in mind that the first sort of real contact between the United States and the then USSR was in space. It were the space engineers from both sides that in the 60s started to talk to each other to create these symbolic linkings of their spacecraft in space. I mean, from some point you could say that the de-icing the Cold War actually started in space.
That's a great. What I constantly have to think about is the Carl Sagan remark that we went to the moon and discovered Earth because of the overview effect. When you talk about inspirational, I think it's not only astronauts going somewhere, but also just ourselves finding our place in the universe. So it's not only shooting rockets up and monitoring the Earth, but also just looking out into space and seeing what our place is.
That's very romantic, and I do agree to some of the...
I love romantic things.
Yeah, I know, that's fine. I appreciate it very much, but the cynical part of me actually also says, we went to the moon and we stopped building atomic bombs. Because going to the moon was also part of a weapon race, which became completely nonsense. And at some point, the powers at that point went over from building more and more and even more powerful atomic bombs to building rockets to go to the moon. I don't care how much it costs. It had cost. It's worth it because it didn't go into nuclear bombs.
Exactly. So, but that also means that you don't have to be cynical about it. I believe it's. I believe Carl Sagan actually that was the reason why he said it, because it was actually a military mission to go to the moon. Yet, eventually, when they look back, it's like, oh, wait a minute, we are all together on this very, very small mote of dust in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Isn't it? Maybe we should look at ourselves as humans on planet Earth instead of divide ourselves by all these, arbitrary countries.
Yeah, and we share the same problems, and that's why in that international space station is a strongly symbolic thing, because you share the same problems with a fairly amount of people, and the basic problem is not going to die. that is very symbolic. I think I'm one of the people that think that the International Space Station should have had the Nobel Prize for Peace for that specific reason.
It's a good one. Yeah, can you submit it? I think you can. You're free to submit. I think the International Space
Station has been done. I think it has been done several times already.
Oh yeah. Okay. Well, we should start a campaign on that. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. But when I go back to my newspaper example, right? I as a kid I was inspired by space, but at a certain point I felt that it's not part of our public discourse enough, or it's very easy to ignore space news, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the newspaper example, to be honest with you, is a wrong example. I don't mean it in any nasty way, but the reason why a newspaper isn't putting that on the front page is because in the current world of social media, everybody has seen that photo 5 times already. And so if you come the next day with a photo on the front page, you're 1 day late. And so a newspaper doesn't want to be late. So they need...
Yeah, that's true.
So it's not so much that they don't find it important. They're just too slow for that level of information. So on the other hand, I mean, as I just said, before you even started this complaint, everybody had seen this, this in your mind. I mean, everybody had seen the picture 5 times. Yeah.
Hopefully, I am in all honesty usually pretty astounded by how out of tune people around me are to anything space related. People know Hubble pictures in general; they don't know what they're looking at. Like, they have no clue. They just look at pretty pictures.
Yeah, but to some level, I mean, people are ignorant to the fact that how transistors in their mobile phone work, and
they don't value very much their mobile phone.
They're very ignorant of how much space actually comes into their mobile phone. And the problem is, the question is it necessarily a problem that people use space? As soon as you touch your phone, you use space mostly by sat-nav, and they have no idea. Is that a problem? I'm not so sure, because they also don't know how their car works. Yeah, so what?
If they like the pictures from Hubble, that's okay. I mean, that's better than that they would not like it.
Of course. And I don't want to be the complainer. It's just very, very often when I talk about these things with friends or something, I ask them if they know what the sun is. Like, just what's the sun? I think it's very sort of like a nice little question to start off a conversation about space. And I'm pretty astounded at people who have had PhDs in other fields, history or literature or whatnot, are in general completely ignorant as to what the sun is. I was as well. I was for the first, I think, 25 years of my life ignorant to certain things like that. And and I feel that your job, Michel, is made harder by that, because people, the general knowledge about outer space, about the Earth being a planet and what that means,
is, and maybe even general scientific principles.
This
is pretty unknown.
Some physics, gravity.
Am I alone on this?
You know?
This is how it feels. And so
I agree.
So that space, in order to get it to the people, you always see that people are fascinated about it because you're sort of showing them a world or a realm that they know nothing about. But
there's fascination on the level of pictures, I guess, and fascination on the level of people who are there. You know, manned spaceflight is much more interesting to the public than unmanned spaceflight, which is a problem, by the way, because in terms of scientific results, Michel, please say something about this. manned spaceflight is more of a problem than a solution, because unmanned spaceflight yields much better results.
Doing science on a space station is a very, very difficult thing to see to do. I was going to be even more outspoken, but let me phrase it carefully, not to get in a fight with people. But it's very difficult to do, and it's the reason for it is quite simple to understand, because it just takes a very, very long time to prepare a space experiment. And by the time that your space experiment is up and launched, it will be delayed and then delayed again and then delayed another time. And then it's up in space station and running. And by that time, the scientific field that you're working in has progressed another 5 years. And you're at that point trying to find the answer to the wrong question, because the question has evolved, the field has evolved. Yeah. So from that point...
So you're actually saying space experiments are useless.
Manned space experiments are very difficult to do. Let me put the value, I feel the value of space station is very large, but the scientific value of space station we shouldn't oversell.
And what is what topics is the public most interested in, you think? What do you feel from your point?
It's funny enough, the space itself, so planets and exoplanets, that type of topic is always quite close to people's heart. I mean, I do remember a few years ago I was on a campsite in France, and it turned out that the campsite owner actually had a telescope, so I asked him, can I use it? Because and then he said, no, yeah, you, it was lying on the shelf somewhere. He said, yeah, but this one is crap. And at home I have a much better one, so I'll bring it over. And what then happens is that during that evening you have the whole campsite around the telescope, so doing observations of Jupiter and that sort of things, and everybody loves it. And then, oh, by the way, now if we stay around for another 10 minutes, then we can see space station coming over. The whole campsite is on your on your lips. So in that size, the fascination is still there. People are, however, swamped with so much information that they're not always listening to you, which. It makes sense. Yeah, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but the fascination for space is on this specific level of planets, and the other one, big one, by the way, is how astronauts go to the toilet. On that level,
that's right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I was waiting for an opportunity to talk about this, because I love your answer about the campsite, and it's no doubt true. But if you look at what has been the most successful thing publicity-wise from the space station, then it's all those videos from this Canadian astronaut that I'm forgetting the name of.
Chris Hadfield.
That's right, Chris Hadfield, who played guitar in space, and he even played with... the band that I'm forgetting the name of.
Ground Control to Major Tom, you mean? David Bowie?
He played that, but he also played with some band. Maybe I'll remember it. But anyhow, he made videos about brushing your teeth in space and eating in space and all that stuff. And those simple human things, I don't think there's a lot wrong with that. But of course, it's not about science, and it's not about discovering new things about physics or the world or space itself. But it's about people living in space, and that's the level that most members of the public are interested in.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe,
Michel, if I can give you an example, What I always find amazing is, for example, exoplanets is a really good one. These discoveries are made.
The band, in by the data. Way, was Bare Naked Ladies.
Oh, Bare Naked Ladies. Okay, thanks, yeah. Thanks, Herbert. Good.
Carry
band.
On.
Love that band. So when an exoplanet is discovered, it's like a dip in a graph, right? Mm-hmm. It's visually, you have to really know what you're looking at, and it's just raw data almost plotted out in a graph. If you put that in a newspaper, then of course everybody will be puzzled by it. But so you see that with the discovery of exoplanets, you need this extra layer of visualizations and press releases and a lot of explanation before the general public can even start to understand what the discovery is. This must make your work really hard if you have like a gigantic discovery but no visuals. How do you work?
Over the last few years, the thing that I've been more busy with was quantum mechanics. From that point of view, space is very easy. because it is there. The problem with quantum, the problem is that you have to explain that something that might be there might is at the same time is not there, and that people are really confused. So in a certain way, you need some freedom. You need to give each other some freedom in how to interpret it, these little dips and to allow some sort of let's say imagination into the game. However, you do have to realize that communication is always about people. It's not about technology. People don't, apart from us engineers and nerds, we do care how something works. But the rest of the world really don't care about how something works. They either want to be fascinated by it, or you want to know what it is good for. So the big question of journalists is always, okay, nice discovery, but what is it good for? And the good scientific answer is we have no idea yet. There are two exceptions, and that's the fun bit about it. There are two exceptions to this rule. I mentioned them earlier. One of them is dinosaurs. What is it good for that we discovered a new kind of dinosaurs? No journalist ever asked that question. And the same thing with space. What is it good for that we have discovered this wonderful exoplanet? It's still news without the what's it good for question. So in that sense, it's actually a walk, in a certain way, it's a walk in the park from a communication point of view.
Yeah, I like this part because I remember some professor in the United States once decided to teach physics by using superheroes. Superheroes, superheroes and throwing stuff, superheroes and building something, you know. And whereas if you teach physics the usual way, students will ask, what is it good for and all that. And if you use superheroes, they don't. Yeah. It's the same physics, but they stop asking the what is it good for question where superheroes don't matter very much in the practical world, you know. So it's very interesting the way you present your stuff, what's it good for question comes at all.
Yeah, the fun thing about communications in more general terms is that you need to understand that communications is about emotions. It's about people, but it's also about emotions. And the emotion of space is normally wow. which is, as I said, a walk in the park at some level. But you also have to keep in mind that if you communicate to people, you always basically communicate to the prehistoric core in people because we have been developed for millions and millions and millions of years to live in prehistoric conditions, which is genetically imprinted in us. So and for about 20,000 years or something like that, we've added civilization to it. Civilization is not in your DNA, It's something that you have been taught by your parents, but it's not in your DNA. If you want to connect to people, you need to connect to the core of their prehistoric being, and that's about I don't want to die. It's also about what is on the other side of the hill. And that is the fascination from space is very much which wonderful opportunity might there be for us new cattle that we can hunt on the other side of this hill.
So that we don't die.
Let's go there and make some extra children. That is. by the way, I need to go to the toilet, which is what.
See what's over the hill. Maybe we can make more children and not.
I mean, that's also why journalism is so focused on bad news. I mean, if you if you communicate, if we would discuss about wonderful flower that is outside our little cave, then you could completely ignore the wonderful flower and continue with your thoughts. But if I would point it at some bush and say, am I spotting a bear there? Then you need to react, otherwise we will die, because there is danger. And journalism and PR very much work by triggering these emotions that we are prehistorically sensitive to. Otherwise, we don't pay attention.
So is that why you then talk more about, say, asteroids that might hit the Earth or things like that? Is that what you mean, that you have to appeal to those kinds of things? Like, we're all going to die.
I don't, but quite often when I see this news coming up about asteroids going to be very dangerous for the Earth and things like that, then I always check something, and normally I'm right. We're 2 weeks ahead from budget discussions in Congress in the United States. So, I mean, in that sense, these kind of emotions are always used, played with to create a certain amount of attention to NASA is very important, so don't cut our budget. That is what the communication means.
Herbert, I'm not sure if you have a question, because I got a question about NASA versus ESA. So if I can pop that one in.
That's a good idea. I'd like to talk about NASA versus SpaceX, but let's do your one first.
Okay, let's go first ahead. From Europe. So, Michelle, so I've worked in the States for quite a bit, and one of the things that I always found remarkable between ESA and NASA is NASA is pretty ubiquitous in their PR. They're everywhere. They very often in their press releases talk about the biggest, the greatest, the newest, the largest, etc. And I found ESA to be a lot more muted. I have to. Maybe around Philae and the whole the landing on Rosetta, and that was all really big and really huge. But usually, I find NASA to be a bit more ambitious in their PR. Is that something that you see?
Yeah,
as well?
That's true. And it's explainable via you have to understand a few things. One of them is that ESA is mainly a highly political organization, in a mm-hmm. sense that it is a project management organization has to make sure that we launch something that work out of let's say contracts to a few thousand companies distributed over all Europe, because everybody needs to share in the end. In the end, everything needs to fit together. And by the way, we have to make sure that we don't end up in a fight and in a blame game. this makes the communication normally very careful. In my opinion, by the way, a bit too careful. And also
that's my opinion too.
Yeah, no, but I do agree to that. Very much politically focused. Yeah. And you just mentioned the Philae Lander event, which is a very nice example, because what you saw there was not one event, there were two events. First, you had the official landing moment, which was pretty clear, went slightly wrong, let me put it that way. It didn't go the way it was foreseen. Now, I do remember from the time that I was working there, because Rosetta was actually launched when I was still working there, a long time ago. I went to Space Expo for the launch event at least three nights, I remember, before the thing actually went to space. But nevertheless, it was in that time already foreseen that this landing process might be very difficult, because you have no idea what you're landing on, and they had a harpoon and some screws, and so whether it would work, nobody knew. Which is understandable, because you can't test it. The fun thing is that during the official landing event, there was a lot of hooray and applause, and we landed on a comet. And I'm never looking at the Bobos in front of the screen, also not on the first row of ground controllers, because they have been ordered to cheer and applaud. I'm always looking one row or deeper into the and I saw staring at screens, pretty puzzled, and then I realized this is not good. this is at least not what they expected that would happen, and indeed it turned out that it was actually bouncing two times before it settled on the surface.
Yeah, true.
But then you get eight or nine speeches of completely boring people, because there's so many countries and so many companies involved. Everybody needs its 2 minutes of fame, which normally is not 2 minutes, but 15 minutes. So it takes, it is completely boring. And then the next day, I think it was on a Friday, I remember, then they were trying to actually to get this lander to work, but there was no event. But there was a lot of, in the same control room, a lot of excitement and fuss to get at least before the battery would die and drop down the 3-volt minimum type of thing, to squeeze as much science out of the little machine as they could. That was actually covered online by multimedia people and by good communication people, while all the, let's say, the VIPs were gone and they were now free to do a good job. And then suddenly it turned out it became an amazing night. I think I went to bed at 3 o'clock or something like that when it went. Finally died, me and all the space friends, because everybody, including André Kuipers, was on Twitter online following, let's say, and cheering to a little box on a faraway comet, keep on going.
Yeah, rightfully so.
Yeah, it was a lot of emotion in it.
Where NASA would have probably, I don't know, would have created multiple of these moments and used those moments in later later after movies to promote.
Let me add one thing, because there's a huge difference between ESA and NASA, and that the huge difference is that NASA owns the complete machine, in a sense that that they own all the cameras, they own all the instruments, and that means they own all the PR. In European missions, ESA does not. That means that the instruments, and I remember this when you put one of the Mars landings, I think, that the instruments, and so also the pictures, are not owned by the European Space Agency, but by local government organizations or companies, etc., which have their own agendas and sometimes not so much feeling for PR, like we're not going to distribute a picture, but we'll keep it in our pocket for a few months and then.
Yeah, which is like amazing to me, because NASA's stuff is all in the public domain, so everybody can use it. And ESA's pictures are restricted.
Yeah, which I think the organization has learned over time. So in the past it was worse than it is now. I think that with upcoming missions you might see that it's different, because they have now you need to arrange this in the contract phase, which is very, very early in the process. And then PR is totally not in sight yet. Nobody thinks it's PR. And then when you go do the PR, then you figure out that you're not in charge of distributing the pictures, because another party is, and this other party has another agenda. So by now they have, I think they, I'm not sure because I'm not working there anymore, but I think they have much better incorporated PR in the early phase into the so that helps. The other thing that NASA does very well, I need to compliment them on that, is that they make all their graphics or videos all completely public domain.
Exactly.
If you want to do a commercial, then you're completely free to use it except for the logo. Which you cannot. Yeah. But if you want to make an Heineken a commercial of landing on the landing on Mars, now the Dutch now it's up to the Dutch, was something like that a few years ago, and it turned out that the lander folds itself into a bar where you can come up and have some Heineken. So see if
on
Mars. Let's if there is life, the Dutch can find it. I think that was just the slogan, and it was all done with NASA animations that you can completely freely use.
Yeah, I use them very often for all kinds of communications material, and it's wonderful that it's free. And it's really weird that some of the very big ESA, for example, telescopes or projects like that, they're not in the public domain.
The reason is that ESA doesn't own the instruments in its telescope, and also in the past at least, therefore doesn't own the science that comes out of it. Which creates uphill struggle, which I know from experience.
I even heard the story, and I'm not sure if you know it, around that whole Rosetta lander, there was this fantastic animation, a cartoon, basically, of about, I think, 6 parts, that showed the whole journey, and I think it showed Rosetta and Philae as a couple... Mm-hmm. Venturing out into the world, and my 5-year-old cousin was completely mad about this. She was a complete fan. And then I heard it was this animation studio in France, I think, who had suggested it to ESA. It wasn't even commissioned by ESA. It was just an animation studio that, out of sheer enthusiasm for the mission, had made this. And then after a while, ESA said, "Well, okay, sure, it's so cool that we will actually buy it." I'm not sure if you can confirm this story.
I don't know, but it is. I wouldn't be surprised if it's true, but it's I don't know.
Yeah, and it's one of the most it's one of the best PR things ESA has ever done, and I believe it wasn't even initiated by.
Yeah, but on the other end, it's the same thing for NASA, but they're much more easygoing on it in the sense that most of the their PR, of course, is done by blockbusters like Apollo 13, which they quite happily work with. On the other hand, it makes a huge difference from a fascination point of view to whether you have put a man on the moon or not. Huh? Let's be honest about that.
Yeah, that's true, of course. Yeah, that's true. Herbert, you wanted to ask your question about SpaceX.
SpaceX, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that as far as publicity, PR is concerned, that NASA is losing the battle with SpaceX, right? SpaceX is stealing the show all over the place, not only with their launches and landings, but also with videos, with tweets by Elon Musk, etc. How do you feel about that, Michel? Is that a right observation by me?
I'm not so sure. I mean, you're at this specific moment, you're right, and I don't think that. But by the way, it's necessarily a bad thing. Although I do think that we are seeing a few things I would call space marketing, and I hope we have a few minutes to talk about it, which I'm not very happy with.
Yeah.
But the fact that SpaceX is doing its corporate communication properly, oh, by the way, by learning from other parties who have done it before, and so they're built, standing on the shoulders of giants in that sense, but they're doing it well. And Elon Musk has a good feeling for PR. However, what happens now is that you see many other parties, and sometimes even SpaceX, that launch stories which are, let's say, on the edge of unbelievable or untrustworthy, let me put it that way. And a lot of these stories, like hotels in space or one-way tickets to Mars, are usually picked up by the media because they're fascinating, while there isn't really any beef behind it. And this, I think, is worrying, because in the end, it will degrade the trust that people have in space organizations for delivery.
You mean like plans that are being put forward that never materialize?
Yeah, and I mean, even ESA also puts forward a lot of plans, and so does NASA, that don't materialize, or at least always delay, but that is fine. Reason why it doesn't materialize, but sometimes plans are put forward for strategics or straightforward, sometimes even pretty questionable commercial reasons that are put forward, and then you already know from the beginning that will never materialize.
Okay, but can you give me an example of a plan that's being put forward for commercial reasons?
Well, the Mars One is a tricky one, there was a recently in also in the Netherlands a better example even of a company that would actually wanted to create the first space baby. I'm sure.
Yeah, we had them on the show.
That makes me very sad in a way, because if you look at what happens there, is that they this in the end I think for various ethical reasons and also purely practical things will of course never happen, but the business model behind it is quite interesting, because they're if you really look on the website, the business model is actually to convince people to freeze eggs and sperm and save it for when the space baby can be.
Yep, that's right.
Which is, of course, never. But it's a wonderful business development, because this freezing your sperm and eggs is already possible. It's not even that expensive. So you just make it twice as expensive by adding this space story to it, and you make yourself a lot of money. So
okay, we had them in Space Cowboys podcast number 8, by the way. So people who are becoming curious can go and satisfy their curiosity and listen to that episode.
And now I might be too cynical here, but I see a lot of these PR stories in marketing stories in where space is used.
That's all right.
Where quite often in the end, I'm pretty sure that the space baby, I hope at least, it will never materialize, because it's completely unethical. There will be no government that will allow a company, at least not in the Western world, to allow a space company to launch something like that. It's not viable from a financial point of view, but the business model to make money is very viable. But on the other way, if I'm not sure, maybe you just really want to have the ambition to do it, but maybe not.
I believe he didn't even want to talk about the space baby too much. He wanted to talk about the business model.
But
the media only wanted to talk about the space baby, of course, because it's spectacular to have.
Yeah, and you get a lot of uproar, so you get a lot of attention. So from a PR point of view, it's very clever. But it also degrades at some point trust.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
How about one final question / answer, because we've 1 hour's worth of podcast right now, and we're going to move to close. Mm-hmm. So what's left to be asked, Thijs?
Oh, okay, what's left to be asked? Well, I had a bunch of things, so let me just run through my list in here.
Just the most important one that's left.
Yeah, the most important one. Well, I keep on coming back to that point of how you can sell space the best way. So if you have some advice for us or anybody listening, you're basically saying, well, space sells itself very easily, but if you got some tips or hints, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, well, I would actually turn it around. I mean, the advice is don't oversell it. And I have always a question, that the fundamental question is very Dutch in a way. Okay, if this is the plan, where is the money coming from? So
That's super practical.
Yeah, and it really helps, because if somebody comes up with a space hotel or wants to ferry people.
Or industry.
Yeah, or do mining in space, which doesn't, is viable from a spot, or even ship people to Mars and back, then just do the maths of how is this is going to be paid. And in the most optimistic scenarios, which are ludicrously optimistic, by the way, of how to do it, it just doesn't add up. So
So the man on the moon, for example, the new man on the moon by the United States.
Yeah, but that's the government.
Which, by the way, it's also interesting, Herbert. We talked about it last week, of course. It's if Trump gets reelected, it's right in the last year of his presidency. So that's also one.
I don't believe in that stuff. Even the moon doesn't have a viable business model, as far as I'm concerned.
This is a dream wishing, in the sense that it's completely impossible from the point where they stand now to go to the moon in, what was it, 2 or 3 years?
Five years, and I think they want to do it on a Falcon Heavy.
Yeah, but even then, you have to fit a capsule to a rocket that isn't designed for it. It's not man-rated. This sounds great, and it's so going not to work that.
We'll write you down as a skeptic.
Yeah, but in a way, somebody has to do it. I'm very sorry, the point is, where's the money coming from? And NASA at this point does not have money to go to the moon. They have money to build an SLS rocket. They have money to build Orion, but there is no budget to do the space mission.
Yeah.
And these space missions are always put forward by presidents for political purposes, and have no beef behind them, whatever.
Hardly ever there's a budget to do it. And the big question that you have to ask yourself, okay, where's the budget? And then you have to decide whether you run the story.
Because if you got enough money, then you can go to the moon in 5 years.
You need probably, what is it, at least 10 billion? Yeah. Well, they always say that Mars is 100 billion. If you do it the government way, yeah. I mean, if you do it one way and are willing to take the risk, is even maybe it's cheaper. But that is quite often the ballpark mark of going to the Mars.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, 100 billion or 10 billion, it's quite the difference, yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. We got you down on the list of skeptic, and we'll talk again in 2025.
And enthusiastic. I mean, I'm not just skeptic.
Well, we noticed that.
Yeah, enthusiastic skeptic.
Certainly.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Hey, so thanks a lot, Michel, for being on the show. And we made it technically happen.
Yes, it did work.
which is also very cool. Yeah.
Okay.
Who do we have next week, Herbert?
Good question. Let me go to our schedule.
Yeah.
Next week we are going to have Lisa Kaltenegger.
Ah, Lisa Kaltenegger from the
Carl Sagan Institute.
Yeah, to talk about.
So we're going to have one more conversation at a distance.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, definitely. She's in at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and she's on the hunt for Earth 2.0. And she's really waiting for the James Webb Telescope to go up, actually. But
to have to wait for some more time then.
Yeah, exactly. But she can tell us a lot about TESS, which already went up.
So okay, that's beautiful.
She already took a peek at some of the data that came from there. So we're going to talk about exoplanets and the hunt for a second Earth.
Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. Thank everybody who listened in. And see you next time on Space Cowboys.
Thank you, Herbert. 16. Thank you, Michel.
Thank you, Thijs. Thanks, Michel.
See ya.
Bye-bye, everybody.